Thank you indeed, Dr. Molnar. Wilhelm Röntgen had a wide variety of disciples. As an economist and a social thinker, not all of the disciples were exactly of the persuasion of those of us present tonight. Röntgen once told me of an interesting episode in his life, occurring not long after the end of the Second World War. He was invited to Florence to receive some high distinction, and he traveled by train to Florence and found himself awaited at the railway station by a splendid party of carabinieri and other gendarmes in great limousines to escort him, it turned out, to the Palazzo Vecchio, the great ancient public hall of Florence. And he was taken with great solemnity and dignity into the heart of the medieval city and ushered into the greatest hall of the Palazzo Vecchio, which is thronged with hundreds of people. Florence was then under a communist government, a municipal government. But all the city magistrates were there, mayor and all the syndics, everyone else. All the great dignitaries, the heads of the great noble families of Florence there also, a strangely mixed gathering, person of every possible political persuasion, and anyone who was of importance in Florence was there. Thronged with people, all of them bowing and scraping with the exquisite Florentine courtesy to the great social thinker, and a sumptuous repast laid out, everything. He never received such a warm and formal, splendid reception in all his life, despite the many distinctions he'd received. He was astounded at this in this communist city. Presently, the crowd gave way to make way for somebody approaching Röntgen. And a man had entered from the main doorway, and he rapidly approached with a kind of scurrying step. He was a grotesquely fat man, fantastically dressed, in loud clothes and a great big tie of some kind, a blowing purple tie, very fat and beaming, with strange and effeminate manners. And everyone made way before him. And he scurried up to Wilhelm Röntgen and seized Röntgen's hands and kissed them ardently and said, "Maestro, maestro," and then withdrew, walking backward before the great social figure and vanished. And the crowd closed around Röntgen again, and Röntgen said to the magistrates who surrounded him, who is that gentleman? They said, "Well, don't you know? Don't you know? Well, he is your disciple. Your chief disciple in Florence. He is the one who arranged your coming here and arranged this reception. He is the head of the Communist Party of Florence." So indeed he was, admiring Röntgen as a seminal social thinker and a great economist, despite his obvious differences in ideology. Well, we have many disciples. We have a disciple of a very different kind tonight to give our concluding address. Dr. Patrick Borman. Dr. Borman has a great diversity of talents. He is, as you all know, the chief translator into English of the works of Röntgen. He is a distinguished professor. I'm always meeting him all over the country and over the years, in Pennsylvania and Long Island and California and elsewhere. And he and his wife and the rising generation of Bormans once came to stay with us at Costa, Michigan. And I offered to put them into the haunted chambers of my haunted ancestral house, but they declined that honor and instead were quartered in our lake cottage for some days. They've now missed the ghost forever because, well, I hope they'll come again before long. The old house was burned just 13 months ago. No scrap of it remains. And according to the local Jehovah's Witnesses, it was burned by the demons which inhabited it. So at least the Borman family did escape the demons of Piety Hill. Patrick Borman has done a great many things. In addition to being a distinguished professor and translator of Röntgen, he's a Briton, of course. Very important economic studies of his own. He's particularly well known as a writer on labor unions and public policy. He has detailed works on finance and monetary questions, notable authority on monetary policy and also on foreign trade. He's been a director of research in various important enterprises, including the activities of the National Association of Manufacturers, eminent in the councils of the Republican Party in Washington as a director of research, and many other posts. At present, Dr. Borman heads a new institute, which is devoted to the relationships between law and economics, and he is going to edit and publish a serious journal about law and economics, of a serious cast, but also, we hope, of a popular cast and of a very considerable circulation. And a special institute has been set up for this purpose, I believe, the help of the Richardson Foundation. You have, many of you, I think, obtained tonight, if you didn't have them before, copies of Repka's Humane Economy, which we got the last supply available and distributed or sold here at the meeting of the Philadelphia Society. And, of course, that is one of Dr. Borman's accomplishments as a translator. I give you our old friend and the benefactor of us all as economist and translator, Dr. Borman.
Thank you very much, Russell, for that nice introduction. And it is a real pleasure, distinct pleasure, to address the Philadelphia Society. I am a charter member, and the last time I had the privilege of addressing the Society in a formal way was in 1964 when it was first established, so I'm happy for this chance to do it again. I do feel that I have to make a few corrections in the record. One is that I am not the translator, Russell, of the Humane Economy, much as I'd like to claim that honor. That was translated by Elizabeth Henderson, very well indeed. I do lay claim, however, to being the translator of Economics of the Free Society. And as long as we're on the subject of that one, Tom Molnar referred to the fact that when he was a youngster in Hungary, he got smuggled to him the very poisonous anti-totalitarian package of Repke's book, and you referred to the Humane Economy as well. However, the Humane Economy, which is the translation of Jenseits von Angebot und Nachfrage, was not published until 1958. The book that you were referring to is Die Lehre von der Wirtschaft, which is Repke's basic economics text and which was translated into English under the title of The Economics of the Free Society. I'm sorry to have to go through this exercise, but I think the credit lines ought to get straightened out. I also, as a student of Repke's, I could stand here for the next 3 days and talk about my memories of the man and my reminiscences of him, and I hadn't time to do that, much as I would like to. I do have a railroad story, however, to recount involving Repke, which will come later. I do remember one story he told of one of his first visits to the United States, and he, of course, one of the things that he tended to criticize about the United States was the obsession with the gigantic, with the super colossal, and with bigness. And he said one day after his arrival here in New York, in New York City, he was wandering about Grand Central Station, and he wanted to get the morning paper, and he accosted a man who had an armful of papers. He said, "Sir, a paper. Boy, a paper." And the man said, "I beg your pardon. That's my Sunday New York Times." So he, in any case, incidentally, since I did mention this book that Tom had in a Hungarian translation as a youngster, it was my great good fortune several years ago on a trip through Spain in an old bookstore in Barcelona to come upon this first edition of Die Lehre von der Wirtschaft, published in 1937 by Julius Springer in Vienna. This relatively thin book, which was the nucleus of a book which then became somewhat fatter as the years went on. And it was this book. This is 37 in the midst of the, I guess, a year before the Anschluss, which took place in 1938. And it was this book that circulated clandestinely in many parts of Europe during this period, and was indeed a sucker to those who were under the heel of the totalitarian. The evening is late, and I wish to direct my remarks very directly to the theme that I have assigned myself in this colloquy, and which has to do with a particular approach that Repke had to life, to science, and to the subject of economics in particular. In this brief period, it is obviously not possible, much as I would like to cover in any adequate way the enormous span of Repke's interests and accomplishments. So I have elected to focus on just one aspect of his approach and his philosophy, but one that, in my opinion, proved decisive in the practical implementation in our time of some of Repke's ideas. I refer to his overriding concern for balance, for proportion, for moderation in all things. One of his most important books, as yet untranslated in English, bears the characteristic title Maß und Mitte, which may be liberally translated as measure and moderation. Conversely, he rejected all artificial schemata, be they economic, sociological, or philosophical, and however tricked out in elegant mathematical formulae, that tended to make out of human beings, who are in reality infinitely rich and variegated and unique, one-dimensional pieces of matter. In that spirit, he took to task repeatedly the growing dominance of a particular scientific method, namely the quantitative causal deterministic method, which, beginning with Galileo and Newton, took over initially and perhaps logically the natural sciences, and subsequently and most fatefully the behavioral and social sciences, with a gradual suppression of all qualitative, theological, moral thought. But while denouncing with undiminished vigor the quantitative geometric approach to human behavior, which he viewed as essentially anti-human, Repke was himself one of the most lucid and ardent proponents of a rational economics based on the free market, on private property, on competition. In his historic contributions to the science of economics, building on the work of his great predecessors in the classical tradition, he constantly emphasized the need for a non-emotional, non-hysterical approach to economic questions, and he underscored the dangers of an economically ignorant moralism which, trying to build a good society in disregard of the economic verities of the laws of supply and demand, would end in the destruction of the foundations of material well-being and the inevitable accession to power in this extremity of totalitarians of the left or of the right. At least half of Repke's huge outpouring of tracts, essays, and books is concerned with this theme of defending the principles of economics against an anti-rational, obscurantist, pseudo-moralism. It was such an approach, overlaid with nihilism, that began to take hold in his own country in the early 1930s, that took over completely in the Nazi period, and that in spite of the manifest successes of the free economy in the post-war period, were again on the rise in the final years of Repke's life. Hence it was and remained for him a first order of business in the struggle for human freedom to make clear over and over again that the market economy is not the only economic system, is not the only economic system which accords with that freedom, but that to our great and undeserved good fortune, it is the most productive as well. That government is not some kind of fourth dimension, a cornucopia of goodies that can be endlessly tapped without cost. That scarcity is still the fundamental law of economic life, and that everything we have and hold is likely to go down the drain if the market economy is destroyed. In all these respects, the market economy is a thing to be prized. It has an immanent ethic that adapts it to the highest goals of our culture. But it is Repke also who reminds us of the other half of his monumental work, the point that was underscored by my friend Tom Molnar, that the market economy, valuable as it is, does not exhaust human nature, that it is subordinated, indeed, to higher ends. The German title of what was perhaps Repke's most representative work is in this regard significant. The German title, rendered, as we've heard, as a humane economy, is Jenseits von Angebot und Nachfrage. Literally translated, it means beyond supply and demand. For Repke, the most important things do, in fact, lie beyond supply and demand. While one must have bread, he cannot live by bread alone. In short, while Repke remained a trenchant critic of economic know-nothingism, which believes that only the perverse workings of the capitalistic system prevent everybody from having everything he wants all the time, he was equally opposed to a morally and spiritually obtuse economism, uncaring of or contemptuous of the things which lie beyond supply and demand. In this connection, I think it can fairly be said that Repke, with his perception of the infinitely complex and variegated sources of human happiness, and with his immense knowledge of the literary, cultural, and spiritual legacy of the past, and of the essential links between the past and the present, was uncomfortable with the simplistic mechanics of an exclusively economic interpretation of human affairs. One small vignette symbolic of this point is worth mentioning, and here is where I come to my railroad story. In 1946, being then a student in Repke's seminar, I was accorded for me the enormous privilege of being invited to his home in Champelle, which is a suburb of Geneva. We got to discussing the war just over and the unimaginable horror of it. And Repke recounted a recent episode in which, in descending from a train in the Zurich railroad station, he met, quite by accident, his old friend and colleague, Ludwig von Mises. As they talked about the war, then reaching its denouement with the Russians in Berlin, von Mises said that if only the principles of free trade had been followed from the beginning, World War II might never have happened. I don't recall what Repke's exact reply to this was, but he seems to have been struck dumb, flabbergasted, and he remarked to me that it was incredible that anyone with a fair knowledge of German or of European history could reduce the German question, the darkest and most somber question of the age, with its roots reaching back hundreds of years to the Reformation and beyond, to the peculiarities of German character and history and philosophy, to a mere set of economic arrangements. For Repke, this kind of economic determinism, though it argues for the total exclusivity of capitalism, is just as fallacious and just as much to be repudiated as the Marxian version of economic determinism, which prefers the total exclusivity of communism. Both are wrong in equating society and history with the economy, however the latter may be organized. So it was, too, that Repke, a man born in 1899, hence with one foot, so to speak, in the 19th century, could look back on that century, and confronting the gruesome horrors of the 20th century, of which he was to have personal experience, could find a great deal to admire, in particular the signal accomplishments of the infant capitalistic economy of the early 19th century. But he also found much to condemn in the subsequent evolution of historic capitalism, with its incipient tendencies toward monopolism and giantism, its obsessive materialism, its drive toward mass production and the associated erection of a mass culture based on mass consumption, and the attendant shrinking of the spheres still left to the individual, to individual creativity and initiative, and to the unbought graces of life, a Burkean phrase he was fond of citing. In historic capitalism, he saw also the seeds of a later full-blown hostility to the preservation of the small organic community, to small industry, to the peasant farmer, to a way of life, as we have heard, made to the measure of man. If Repke himself had an obsession, it was his passionate detestation of the cult of the colossal, of the accoutrements of an increasingly mechanistic, quantitative, super-efficient, perfectionist, and mathematized culture. He saw this cult, expanded to a culture, as the progenitor of the mass man, spiritually starved, desperately bored, and hence critically vulnerable to the new pseudo-religions of nationalism and socialism, and to pseudo-prophets such as Marx, Stalin, Hitler, and whomever. He believed that one of the most noxious of the poisons of modernity, a hallmark of the vertical eruption of barbarianism in our time, was its furious contempt for the past, and he bemoaned the educational Jacobinism and spiritual egalitarianism which sees in the maintenance of a classical tradition the teaching of Latin and Greek a symbol of elitism. hated by mass man, unable to summon the discipline that such study requires.
Can I have a glass of water, please?
Thank you. And in that context, he related to me an incident in the German parliament, the Bundestag, in which a social democrat member of the Bundestag angrily responded to the use of the three-word Latin phrase Vigilia pretium libertatis. Vigilance is the price of liberty. And the social democratic member of the parliament got up and expostulated as follows. Reden Sie Deutsch im Deutschen Bundestag. Speak German in the German parliament. It was against this grotesque putting down of the great legacy of our past that Röpke fought an unending, if often discouraging, battle. One of his favorite verses from Goethe, from whom he often quoted, was the following. He who of 3,000 years knows not account to give, unknowing through the darkness peers from day to day to live. And then thinking of the comment that was made earlier with regard to Japan and Röpke's delight, or the Japanese being delighted at the... And Röpke's delight, or the Japanese being delighted at the fact that he wasn't going to lecture them on democracy. I found this in one of Röpke's papers published in 1957 called Die Massengesellschaft und ihre Probleme, The Mass Society and Its Problems, and he has a marvelous quotation from Herman Melville. Myriads playing pygmy parts, debased into equality. In glut of all material arts, a civic barbarism, maybe. Dead level of rank commonplace, an Anglo-Saxon China. See, may on your vast plains shame the race in the dark ages of democracy. Thought that was pretty good. Right. Correct. I think a fine example, and I don't want to drag this out unduly, of this dimension of Röpke's thought, that is, of his concern for balance and for the golden mean, for the legacy of history, is a foreword he once wrote to an early edition of that same little book, Die Lehre von der Wirtschaft, and which has not appeared in English. If I may, I would like to take just a few sentences of that on this occasion on which we are honoring his memory. To give you some typical passages. It would, he says, be a profound misapprehension to imagine that a slogan embodying a mere return to old-style rugged individualism is the battle cry that will help us win the spiritual victory over collectivism. For we cannot ignore the fact that the debacle of economic liberalism, and he's using the word liberalism here in the old European sense, not the perverted American sense, is due in great part to its own insufficiencies, to its abortive endeavors, to its degeneration. Nor can we any longer deny that the chief causes of this decay are to be found in humanity itself, the spiritual, moral, and political aberrations which fostered the creation of a mass society and the revolt of the masses which such a society engenders. Now it is precisely certain economic and social developments of the liberal era, or we might say today here the capitalistic era, that have contributed decisively to this evolution. In order, therefore, to study and judge these developments, we must keep an open mind and not tie ourselves to the economic platform of historic liberalism. I am looking, he continues, beyond laissez-faire and collectivism, for a third road, the only road which still remains open to us. Elsewhere, I have described what we may expect to encounter along this road: an economic and social order founded on liberty, justice, and human dignity, an order which does not neglect the nature of man, and one which, while giving free rein to the powerful instinct of self-preservation, adds to its other benefits that of material abundance. In looking for this road, I seek to avoid one of the deep-seated fallacies of our time, which Thierry Mulnier felicitously named the Manichaean doctrine, The habit, that is, of thinking always in pairs of diametrically opposed ideas and of confining oneself without exception to an exclusive choice between two extremes, inflation or deflation, laissez-faire or planned economy, etc. Let me try, he goes on, to make myself as clear as possible by considering first the negative pole, collectivism. What it offers us is by now no secret. Suppression of freedom and of the human personality, exaggerated mechanization, proletarianization on the one hand and centralization on the other. In fine, society is reduced to a kind of formless paste in which the apparatus of power alone counts. Man, stripped of his dignity and his individuality, becomes the mere plaything of a group in power recklessly applying its arbitrary plans and programs. A society of this kind, however, and this is the key thought here, is merely the final consequence of a long pre-totalitarian evolution characterized by increasing mechanization and proletarianization, an evolution common to the whole Western world. The acuteness of the disease varies, of course, from country to country, but in certain areas it has already reached the final stages of degeneration. Pathological urbanization, the paralyzing influences of monopolies and government intervention, and the brutal domination of pressure groups have all but destroyed the delicate nervous system of the market economy. Let us not attempt to deny that this process of gradual arteriosclerosis, which finally ends in the apoplexy of totalitarianism, began in the era of world liberalism. And the liberals cannot plead the excuse that this evolution would have been halted if only a serious effort had been made to apply the liberal program of economic freedom. Economic freedom is no doubt a necessary condition for the maintenance of the good society, but scarcely a sufficient one. There is grave danger of allowing ourselves to be distracted from the main issue by exclusive concern with this one point, important though it may be. The main issue becomes clear if we ask ourselves the question, what is the opposite of the opposite pole of collectivism? Economic freedom? Hardly. A return to economic freedom would certainly lessen monopoly abuses and would eliminate some other imperfections of the economic system. But would there be any significant change in the other morbid phenomena of our time? Would a country which no longer has farmers or artisans or a stable middle class get all these things at one fell swoop thanks to economic freedom? Would the proletariat disappear? Would the community achieve economic and social stability? Would social justice finally prevail? Would the individual find more meaning and dignity in his work? But if a simple return to economic freedom will not procure all these advantages, how can we expect people to become enthused over such a program? Must we not offer something in addition? Economic freedom and competition, and I'm still quoting from this passage and it's coming to an end, are obviously indispensable arms in a battle against the entrenched evils of collectivism and monopoly. But they are only the forward guns of a far-flung and constantly shifting battle line. Let no one be deceived. A great deal of time will be necessary to make improvement in the present pathological condition of our society. It is easy to deforest the land, but once the topsoil has been washed away by rain, it will take years to restore fertility to the denuded areas. For 100 years, we have mined the mysterious reserves of the social soil. We are like the farmer who has recklessly wasted his land and who then tries to remedy his mistake by applying ever bigger doses of artificial fertilizer. A great crust forms on the land. Its delicate organic life disappears. Hyperacidity develops, and the patient accretions of humus are washed away by the rain. In a few countries, the totalitarian ones, the bare stone is already visible. But what of the so-called free countries? To describe the third road adequately, he goes on, would require an entire volume. And of course, subsequently, he did describe this road in a number of books, including The Humane Economy. Nevertheless, he says, I should like to mention the chief signpost that would be encountered along this road. Decentralization on a wide scale and in all spheres of activity. Encouragement of small producing units and of sociologically healthy types of living and working, as, for instance, independent farming. Erection, and note this, erection of effective legal obstacles to monopoly and to excessive concentration in industry, and so on. The third road also envisages the growth of new non-proletarian types of industry, the reduction of all sizes and relationships from the huge and inhuman to the measure of man, the end of an exaggerated specialization and division of labor. A more equal division of property would be encouraged wherever possible, and government interventions would be designed not to frustrate, but to conform to the market economy. But above all economic programs and economic policies must be placed the great work of converting society, morally, politically, and spiritually. Our society is in dire need of some reflection on what constitutes a just scale of values. There must be a new acceptance of the fact that the eternal norms of social conduct are binding on each and all. We can have hopes that a conversion of this kind will take place if we act in such wise that the society ceases to be composed of men who, crowded together in an unnatural economic and social milieu, are degenerating morally and intellectually. And that's the end of the passage. In conclusion, I think it's most important to note that it was because Repke was not tied to the platform of historical capitalism that his prescriptions for the reestablishment of the market economy in Germany after the war met with acceptance on the part of his countrymen. That concept had, in fact, been so thoroughly discredited, that is, historical capitalism, that the word capitalism was and is never used to describe what took place in Germany after 1948. The accepted terminology is the social market economy. And note well that in this concept, which of course lay behind the German economic revival, the state, the government, is taken for what it is, a locus of power that is great and undoubtedly expanding. Though Repke was an enemy of big government, as he was of big anything, and feared the misuse and abuse of government power, he believed that rightfully used, it could play a major role in the creation and establishment of those framework institutions, monetary, fiscal, and juridical, that are crucial to the survival of the market system. It seems to me that American conservatives, who are concerned to preserve the market economy in the United States, perhaps have an important lesson to learn from Repke and the German experience in this regard. Thank you.